From Arezzo, Italy, I'm Suzette Gorlot, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma, and welcome to Worldviews. Political scientist and self-described military sociologist Zoltan Barani argues it's possible to predict how a general will respond to a domestic revolt if we know enough about the army, the state and society it serves, and the external environment.
The tasks of building an army in a society that was driven by all kinds of major conflicts will be very different than in a more unitary society.
But first, I'll talk with Rebecca Cruz about former Boko Haram kidnapping victims in Nigeria and the expansion of NATO after the small Balkan country Montenegro was invited to join.
Well, Russia has obviously seen this as a strategic play by NATO, a bit of a slap in the face.
But first, this hour's news. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlot. Rebecca Cruz, let's do an update on Nigeria, on the activities of Boko Haram, the terrorist organization there, military insurgents. The last time we talked about them some time ago, we were providing an update about some of the kidnappings that have been going on, the girls that have been stolen from school and otherwise to be sex slaves and to serve other purposes. Well, interesting news this week. One of those girls has been found alive, wandering in the forest. Other victims and other former young girls that have been kidnapped have also been found or have reemerged in their communities, and they aren't really welcome. They're telling these stories about how the communities that are shunning them. These young girls are being stigmatized. They're being beaten. The community members are suggesting that there's a lack of trust. They find that they've been brainwashed. They're having insurgent babies. I mean, this is just a really sad case. They've been traumatized by being kidnapped, and now they're being traumatized when they return to their communities. But this isn't the first time we've seen this happen. We've seen this happen in other parts of Africa, for example. But, you know, what are we to expect, and how are we to think about these tragic events?
Well, unfortunately, this just goes to show how impactful or powerful Boko Haram is, because they are able to do this and to then create the sort of fear that comes from this. Part of the reason that these girls are being shunned is because Boko Haram has known recently to use girls as suicide bombs. So young girls are going into areas and are being detonated in some fashion or another. And so there is this level of suspicion that comes about, thinking that perhaps these girls are being used in some fashion, or that they are traitors in some fashion. And the other thing that's happening here is obviously many of them are sex slaves, and they are becoming impregnated. And so their children then are also seen as traitors. They are the offspring of soldiers. Some of which, as may be the case with this young girl that was found, her husband is saying that he was actually kidnapped as well and forced to be a soldier. So it's on both sides, both genders. But you mentioned we'd heard this story elsewhere. One of the stories we've heard specifically is from Sister Rosemary Nirumbe, who we have met with, and she does work in Uganda, and the same sort of thing happened. And she was able to build a school because the girls were not allowed back into society in the same way, and they needed to find a profession and have ways to find employment.
Well, if it isn't bad enough to be kidnapped, this is a terrible outcome to see how they're not welcome back in society. But at the same time, the results, the outcomes really of horrible civil wars going on in places around the world. Well, let's jump to Southeastern Europe, actually, into the Balkans. This week, Montenegro was invited to join NATO. This is the first country in many years that has been invited to join NATO. And it's taken 9 years for Montenegro to actually to gain membership after it became a candidate country. I believe it's the smallest country to become a member of NATO, only 600,000 residents and a very small military, if much at all. But the Russian response to this is clearly very important for us and for global politics.
Well, Russia has obviously seen this as a strategic play by NATO. NATO has become much more involved with Russia after the situation in Ukraine has escalated. And Montenegro, previously as part of Serbia-Montenegro, and then even as Montenegro, has been an ally of Russia. And so they are seeing this as a bit of a slap in the face, though some officials, particularly within NATO and the United States, are saying that Russia is overreacting quite a bit, that this is a small country that's far, far away from Russia, and that really it isn't much of a strategic ally against Russia, if we're being practical about things.
That this is just an extension, once again, of European expansion, European integration. It's nothing threatening necessarily, but of course the war of words continues between the East and West, in some cases Russia and the United States. We'll definitely continue to watch that. But interesting to see NATO continue to expand. All right. Well, thank you, Rebecca, as always, for being here on Worldviews.
Thank you.
We'd love to hear your thoughts about this show and answer any questions you might have. You can leave your comments online at kgou.org or get in touch with us on Twitter at WorldviewsKGOU. I tweet at Suzek Rilot. After a short break, I'll talk with political scientist Zoltan Barony. He's a professor at the University of Texas at Austin who studies the intersection of military, governments, and society. I'm Suzek Rilot, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzek Rilot. In February 2011, President Obama criticized the U.S. intelligence community for not accurately predicting the unrest in Tunisia would spread to Egypt and other Middle East countries. His harsh words about how quickly Tunisia's military turned against the authoritarian regime caught the attention of my guest, Zoltan Barony. He's a political scientist at the University of Texas at Austin and the author of the book, How Armies Respond to Revolutions and Why. Zoltan Barony, welcome to Worldviews.
Pleasure to be here.
I'd like to start with just your discipline, your field. You've been called a military sociologist. Can you tell us a little bit about what you mean by that? Are you studying civil-military relations, relations within the military? What does a military sociologist do?
So basically, I think I would describe myself as military politics, military sociology, and essentially what I'm really interested in is how the military interacts with the government and how it interacts with society. And so basically the way I look at the civil-military relations, which is really what I do, is at a triangle at the points of which there is the state, there is society, and there's the armed forces. And so the armed forces obviously is an institution of the state, but the armed forces come from society, the conscripts or the professional soldiers. And so their societal links are extremely important. And I think they are often neglected or sort of underplayed. And as we see all the time, whether, for instance, an army is a conscript army that comes and represents all parts of society, or whether it's a professional army that obviously is a self-selected group, makes an enormous difference in how armies behave.
But you are studying official formal state military institutions. I'm just curious, since you just defined what you do, if you're focusing strictly on formal state military institutions, or if any of what you study might be relevant for paramilitary forces or insurgents or any kind of military activist, if you will, that is perhaps operating outside the state?
Yeah, I think it's a very good question, since in the last half century, the paramilitaries, militias, and so on have become extremely important, especially in certain part of the world. But I'm really interested more in the armed forces as an institution of the state. Now, I also study, states also maintain all kinds of paramilitary forces, and that is mostly in my purview, right? So in the Middle East, for instance, but not just the Middle East, in many other areas where in authoritarian systems, the state or the regime is afraid of the military, in many cases for good reasons, and they create, duplicate militaries, and they might call them different names. And so these were also in communist systems and in all kinds of authoritarian states. So yes, that I do study. I don't want to pass myself as an expert on militias or insurgents or that sort of thing, because I certainly am not.
Well, let's talk about your book that you published in 2012, The Soldier and the Changing State. This book is about building democratic armies, and particularly in Africa, Asia, Europe, and the Americas. But I'm particularly interested in this concept of democratic armies. What is it that you mean by that? I mean, clearly you're getting to these relationships between state and society, but what is a democratic army?
So, yeah, I think it's one of those things that you have to sort out very quickly, because obviously militaries are not democratic institutions, they're very hierarchical and so on. But the key here is that I'm interested in how states build armies that are supporters of democratic rule. So building armies that will support the state, as opposed to armies that may be vacillating or turn against the state.
So just to follow up on that, I mean, most of us think of militaries as being in existence to secure the state, to defend the national interest. But are you suggesting that it goes further than that, that it's more than security? It's about protecting a democratic way of life, institutions like elections and rule of law and checks and balances and other kinds of things that you have in democracies, that it's this dual purpose?
No, I think it's the army that I'm interested in that particular book is interested in and supporting of democratic states, not authoritarian states, but democratic states. And so in most cases, so this book actually deals with 27 case studies from around the world, and basically from all continents except for, you know, Australia and New Zealand. And I'm interested in non-democratic states and how do they become democratic and how do they create democratic armies that will support democracies and, if necessary, defend democracies from even within, the state kind of either insurgencies or maybe even parts of the armed forces that is not yet committed to support or defend democracies.
So based on those case studies, then, what did you learn? How is it that we build democratic armies?
Well, it is very, very complex. And so what you find out that it works in many very different ways. So I actually had several categories, because the categories will be extremely indicative of how this work will happen. So, for instance, one of my categories of building democratic armies is after major war, like after World War II, and my cases were Germany and Japan and a socialist state, just to counteract how that doesn't happen and democratic armies do not evolve in the communist countries. Another was after civil wars, because obviously tasks of building an army in a society that was driven by all kinds of major conflicts will be very different than in a more unitary society. Then I looked at another category, which is very common and very large, and it's after military rule. How in various places, and I actually had, I think I looked at 9 different countries from 3 continents, Europe, Asia, and Latin America, and how in these countries, after military rule, military was taken out of politics, which is obviously the most important objective. And then I looked also at societies that were passing by communism, so 3 communist states, and what were the problems in those. And so the problems are very, very different. They're really complex, and where you, so your starting point, in other words, whether it's civil war or a socialist state, will make a huge difference. And then in the end, I also looked at post-colonial states, both in Africa and in Asia. And in the end, in countries that were divided and unified. And so how, when you come from, for instance, a divided Germany or a divided Yemen, do you build a unitary army in from 2 states and from 2 armies? How do you have one? And finally, also in post-apartheid South Africa. So actually, I went to most of these countries and did a lot of field research and talked to a lot of the politicians and generals and so on, if they were available, to get their insights, as well as all the literature that is obviously extant in most of these cases.
That's Zoltan Barony, a self-described military sociologist who teaches at the University of Texas at Austin. Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. I'm Suzette Gorlot, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlot, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. I've been talking with Zoltan Barony. He's a political scientist who teaches at the University of Texas at Austin, and we've been discussing what he calls military sociology in his 2012 book, The Soldier and the Changing State. You were talking about how armies evolve after civil war, after military rule, after colonialism. But how specifically might they respond to revolution? You talk in your book about how generals in particular, how military personnel have a certain mindset about how to respond to these things. Tell us a little bit about that book and what we can imagine regarding the response of armies to revolution.
Right. So It has been an old insight that people like Lenin and Mao and many other social thinkers, political thinkers, had already established that without the support of the armed forces, no revolution will succeed. And so my book certainly confirmed that. But the big question, and so I hope my contribution, is that I think that in many cases you can actually predict whether the army will, which way will the army go. That is, will it support the revolution? Will it oppose it? Or will it actually be divided in its response? And so the idea for me to write this book was actually a speech by President Obama in February of 2011, when he was very critical and openly so of the American intelligence community for not having foreseen the quick collapse of the state in Tunisia. And so I looked into this a little bit, read whatever I could on Tunisia, and I thought that he was right, that it was indeed predictable if you were asking the right questions. And I went and spent a winter in Washington talking to people in various intelligence agencies, and basically they agreed that they were asking the wrong questions all along, because these were very stable regimes, and they did not ask the question, did not look into the instabilities of these regimes, which were also, if you scratch the surface a little bit, they would become more apparent. So basically, I mean, this is what I do is I set up a framework. What are the questions that you need to ask in order to have, at the very least, an educated guess about which way the military will go? In some cases, you can make a confident prediction because it's just so clear that the military will not oppose a regime, for instance, that is an authoritarian regime that's socially divided and has different sectarian groups and so on and so forth. In some other cases, however, it is very difficult to actually predict, and at that point you really just have an educated guess. You ask the right questions, I hope, and then you come up with what hopefully will be something that you can, intelligence analysts can build on.
So, I mean, interesting that you're talking about prediction, as I'm curious about how it is that you really do get to know the military mindset, and if you can generalize from one military to another. I mean, we've just been having this discussion about democratic armies. I mean, some of these you're talking about studying militaries that aren't terribly, that are operating not in democratic governments. So how is it that you're able to really understand and know the military mindset and then predict in these, given the different circumstances, the complexity, all the things that we were talking about before, how a military will respond?
Yeah, so actually, there are hardly ever any revolutions against democracy. So it's all of these contexts tend to be authoritarian contexts or dictatorships. So how do you find out? Well, this is what my framework actually does. That basically I'm posing a number of questions that you need to find the answer to. Some of these are very easily knowable, right? So for instance, is the army, the cohesion of the armed forces is probably the most important question, whether or not are the generals seeing with the same eyes? Are there ethno-religious divisions within the armed forces? Are the conscripts and the non-commissioned officers have the same views as the officer corps? More importantly, are there, for instance, rival institutions, like there is a security institution that maybe is getting marginalized as opposed to the armed forces, vice versa? Most of these countries actually have them. Then you look at still in the armed forces, is it a conscript army or is it an army of volunteers. A conscript army would be much less likely to shoot at people than a volunteer army. And also, what is the military's view of the regime's legitimacy? Now, in some cases, in most cases, it's quite clear. In some cases, it's not everything is knowable. So this is the first sort of four spheres of question that you ask. The second is the state itself. How does it treat the military as an institution? And how does it treat the military as individuals? How well are military people taken care of? Another important question with this regard is there is the regime, the state, is it giving the armed forces clear directions of what they are expected to do? Because surprisingly, in many cases, they don't get instructions. Also, what kind of autonomy does the military have? Is it a military that is straitjacketed by the ruler or the authoritarian state, or is it something where its professionalism had earned it the more autonomy in terms of which way it acts? The third of the four spheres is society, right? So basically, you're looking at the demonstrations. How large are they? Who is demonstrating? Is it young thugs? Or the demonstrators are consisting of the entire society, young women, old people, and so on and so forth. Because the response is likely to be very different from the armed forces. Is there any fraternization between the demonstrators and the military? All of these are important. And then finally, the fourth sphere is external affairs or external dimension, if you will. And so this might mean things like, is the army expecting an invasion or some sort of help either to the army or to the opposition? Is there something like a revolutionary diffusion, for instance, so revolution like it recently spread from in the Arab Spring from one place to another? And there are some other considerations that are more minor.
Well, Dr. Barony, thank you so much for sharing this information. Your framework is really helpful for us, I think, in helping us understand what we might expect from revolution, war, and conflict around the world. So thank you very much.
It was my pleasure.
You've been listening to my conversation with political scientist Zoltan Barony. You can read the introduction of his book, How Armies Respond to Revolutions and Why, on our website, kgou.org. While you're there, you can also subscribe to our podcast or download all of our past shows. KGOU produces Worldviews with the support of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Miranda Wilson prepares our research, and Brian Hardzinski edits our interviews and oversees our digital content. For Rebecca Cruz, I'm Suzette Gorlott.